Okay. So I have senior members signed up to lead the precept classes this year. So there'll be a new person teaching each week. With the exception of the precept, do not kill. I'm still waiting for someone. That's usually one of the first ones to go. It's like, I told my husband about that tonight. And he's like, yeah, that one's kind of hard to buy into. As some of them go, it's kind of straightforward. So if you have received the precepts and you aren't already signed up for a class, then let me know. Otherwise, I'll have to teach it. But I figured I would start off with a class just giving a real overview of precept practice and how we hold it in our lineage. And I'm hoping that I leave enough time that those of you who have practiced with the precepts for a while can chime in and say something about, your experience of it and how it's been valuable. So, just start off by saying, so the precepts, do you want to pass out the chant books so that we can look at the Kyoju Kaimon, which is contains the precepts? And then let's see, Zoom host, that's Bob, right? Can you d put the chant link in the chat again in case people want to pull up the precepts? Not necessary, I'm reading them out loud, but.
While we're passing out the books, do I remember correctly that there is a specific book of Kyogen's teachings on the precept that we have, on all the precepts that we have here?
There's a booklet called, I think it was like Precept Study Classes, which is like transcripts from the Dharmarayana classes. I can't remember if I have a link to that on the website. I compiled all kinds of precept resources.
Okay.
And I would be surprised if that wasn't there, because I think I have a digital copy of it.
Because I thought I used to own it and I can't find my copy.
It's on the website.
Is it on the website? Okay, cool.
Thank you.
Yay. All right. So, moral behavior has always been central to Buddhism. The Buddha's Eightfold Path, three out of eight of the spokes of the wheel or the steps of the path are about action, right speech, right action, and right livelihood. So I would say original Buddhism was largely practical about morality. Basically said, you're not going to be able to go deeply into meditation and, give up attachment to self and achieve mental and emotional calm if you're going around killing and stealing and lying and doing all those kinds of things, doing selfish things. So it was like this was a prerequisite for spiritual practice. You need to get your moral act together. And in original Buddhism, if you're interested, I do a history of the precepts on the Zen Studies podcast, episodes 22 and 23, How Buddhists Should Behave, Evolution of the Buddhist Precepts. But in short, it started with monastic precepts, rules for the Buddha's followers, then they had hundreds of rules governing monastic life. And then there were precepts that the monks took, but also if lay people were to take any precepts, they would basically take six precepts, which correspond to the first six of our grave precepts, which I'll get to in a bit. And then in China, when Mahayana Buddhism really took hold and the ideal of the Bodhisattva became something that wasn't just in original Buddhism, the Bodhisattva was aiming for complete Buddhahood. which isn't just nirvana, but like being a completely masterful teacher and all these other things. And so it was like, they were like the super athletes of the spiritual world. But then it came about in Mahayana Buddhism where, you know, the aspiration to be a bodhisattva and be reborn life after life in order to help other people as well became the ideal. So then there was a whole set of bodhisattva precepts created in China. And I believe in the Brahmajala Sutta, there's about 53 of them. Now, Dogen is our father of Soto Zen. He brought Chaodong Zen or Chan from China to Japan. And when he did that, he only brought over the 16 bodhisattva precepts as we use them. And they were for both monks and lay people. So this is a very fascinating story. And I have more information on it if you're interested. In part, it turns out this was kind of a, I don't know, political thing or a sectarian thing, because at the time in Japan, they had what they called ordination platforms, where when you were going to give this monk these 250 monastic precepts and give them this full ordination, you would have to do it at one of these platforms. And these platforms were controlled by other sects. And so Dogen basically said, we don't need your platforms. And he just ordained people with the 16 bodhisattva precepts. So it allowed his lineage to really be more independent. So just in case you're curious about that kind of thing. So we ended up with these 16 bodhisattva precepts, which have been central to our form, our lineage of Zen for many centuries. And interestingly, the Soto Shu, so the Shu means school, and Soto Shu is the Japanese, you know, school of our lineage of Zen. In the US, we have no such overarching organization. We're all just like cats. We just can't be herded. We just do whatever we want. But in Japan, it's very organized. And if you're part of this school, you know, there's certain education you have to get, certain hoops you have to jump through, and certain rules you have to follow, and all that. And it has its own strengths, right? But it's very different. But they, for many, you know, really, I think especially last couple hundred years, they strongly encouraged people, including lay people, to take the bodhisattva precepts. And they created our ceremony of Jukai, where you receive the precepts, and it really became like, this was what defined the Soto school, as opposed to the Rinzai school or other forms of Buddhism, was the accessibility of these precepts and this ceremony that people could undergo to receive these precepts. So just to briefly review, which is, I'm gonna read them out loud, but you know, they also are in the chant book in the Kyoju Kaiman. So we call them the 16 precepts, but they're really three refuges, three pure precepts, and then 10 grave precepts. So the refuges are considered precepts. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. So that's three of them. And subsequent classes, somebody's going to be talking about the refuges and the karma verse of confession. And then somebody else is going to talk about the three pure precepts. And then there's going to be one person per each grave precept. So then we have the three pure precepts. Do only good, take selfless action. Do good for others, embrace all things and conditions. Do good for others. Oh, wait, cease from harm, release all self-attachment. I missed one there. Cease from harm, do only good, do good for others. Those are the three pure precepts. And as my teachers would say, ideally you wouldn't need any more than that. That covers it. Cease from harmful action, do good action and benefit others. But we need it broken down a little more specifically. So that's where we get the grave precepts. Do not kill, cultivate, and encourage life. Do not steal, honor the gift not yet given. Do not misuse sexuality, remain faithful in relationships. Do not speak dishonestly, communicate truthfully. Do not become intoxicated, polish clarity, and dispel delusion. So those first six are the classic precepts that lay people take, even in Theravadan Buddhism and other forms of Buddhism. But we have these additional ones which come from these Bodhisattva precepts that originate in China. And they become more, you know, so those first six are kind of, they have a real like gritty physical element to them, as well as more subtle elements. But these later ones are a little more about your mind and your speech and your relationships. So then, do not dwell on past mistakes. Create wisdom from ignorance. Do not praise self or blame others. Maintain modesty. Extol virtue. Do not be mean, that is stingy, with dharma or wealth. Share understanding. Give freely of self. Do not indulge anger. Cultivate equanimity. Do not defame the three treasures. Respect the Buddha, unfold the Dharma, and nourish the Sangha. So we'll be going more into each of those as we go. So somewhere along the line, precepts came to be seen as not just a prerequisite for deep practice, but as a description of enlightened behavior. And therefore, they're a very useful practice tool. Are we acting according to the precepts or not? If we are, you know, we're on the right track. If we're not, then there's something there. So they're like a karmic mirror. Whenever we find ourselves breaking precepts or wanting to, it is a sign that the small self has arisen, that our self-interest, our ego, our karma, however you want to describe it, has arisen. And this is not a matter for shame, but an opportunity to take responsibility. That's why we have our confession verse, which you know, we'll be discussing that in the next class. But it really, you know, it can be a little triggering for, you know, ex-Catholics and stuff like this, like we're confessing. And, but it's really, in my mind, it's about taking responsibility from here on out. All my past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. So we acknowledge that, you know, karma is beginningless. And we say a contrite heart is open to the Dharma, this is in the Kyoju Kaimon, and finds the gateway to the precepts clear and unobstructed. Bearing this in mind, we should sit up straight in the presence of the Buddha and make this act of contrition wholeheartedly. So it's not about shame. It's not about beating ourselves up. It's about, you know, being responsible for who we are and what we do. But then even deeper, the precepts reflect what I've been calling lately reality with a capital R. They reflect the truth of emptiness and of interdependence. At a difficult point in my life and practice, many, many years ago, I was really full of doubt. I was full of doubt about where I was practicing and my teacher and my own abilities, and nothing made any sense. But the one thing I clung to was that I knew the precepts were true. That I knew was true. And I knew that, you know, it's like, if you break a precept, there is negative karma that happens. It's just like, it's like a law of the universe. And really this is because of that deeper reason that we all, none of us are actually independent, separate beings, right? What we do affects everyone, and what everyone does affects us. So that these precepts are all about relationship that honors that interdependence. So we say when we break a precept, there is always negative karma, but our intention is pivotal. Our intention has a profound effect on the nature of the results if we break a precept. Are we acting out of greed or self-interest, or are we breaking a precept out of compassion? So that's the one like excuse to break a precept, is out of compassion. And yet we say, even if we break a precept out of compassion, even if, say, we euthanize an animal who's suffering, or we tell someone a white lie because, you know, the hat they knitted for us, they think we really love it, and we say, yeah, it's great, you know, rather than like brutally telling them that we think it's stupid, like, you know, out of compassion, we might lie in that sense, or we might, you know, refuse aid, break the precept of do not be mean with dharma or wealth. We might refuse aid to someone because we actually know that's the best thing for them. And yet, in all of these circumstances, there is still negative karma from it, right? There is still, like, you know, to kill something, even if it's out of kindness, you know, makes us very sad and full of grief, or, you know, the white lies kind of, they might kind of get a little out of control, and pretty soon we're just kind of fudging the truth in other circumstances, or we're not being fully honest with someone. And it hurts to refuse aid to someone, even if we know that's the right thing to do. And for instance, the intention really matters. For example, you know, accidentally killing someone, you know, in terms of manslaughter or something, versus, you know, murder versus deliberate murder. Obviously, the karmic repercussions of those two are going to be very different. And yet we all know if you accidentally killed someone, that is still going to change your life forever. There's still karma from that, even if it's not the same kind. So we view the precepts as extremely important. They are not separate from awakening. They're an essential part of the Dharma. So it's not just a matter of, like, you know, we're going to try to awaken, but we should also clean up our behavior. Or, you know, like, the behavior part is just kind of a lesser task that we need to keep in mind. They're not separate from awakening. As Dogen says in Shobogenzo Zwimonki, when we sit in Zazen, what precept is not observed? What merit is not actualized? It's like our Zazen practice and precept practice are not two separate things. They point us toward the same thing. And then from the Shushogi, so this is a text, very interesting text, you might want to look up. It means the meaning of practice and verification. And this was compiled directly from Dogen's writings by the Sotoshu. So this is another thing that they did around the Meiji era, late 1800s. And this is like the Soto Zen track. Like, this is like they tried to, you know, take these paragraphs from Dogen and lay out the essence of Soto Zen, like what defines our school of Soto Zen. So it's kind of interesting. But this is so I'm not sure where this Dogen passage is also found somewhere else, but it's in this Shushogi. He says, those who receive the precepts verify the unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment verified by all Buddhas of the three times, the fruit of Buddhahood, adamantine and indestructible. Is there any wise person who would not gladly seek this goal? The world-honored one has clearly shown to all living beings that when they receive the Buddha's precepts, they join the ranks of the Buddhas, the rank equal to the Great Awakening. Truly, they are the children of the Buddhas. So it's just, there's a really sweet part in our Jukai ceremony that ends, and I think it's from Dogen's writings as well, which says, you know, these people have taken the precepts, and like some bodhisattvas in the universe say, hey, what's up? And somebody says, oh, there's new people have taken the precepts, and said, oh, then the bodhisattvas bow towards you saying, oh, then you are like us. It's very sweet. So when we aspire to live according to the precepts, we're saying we want to live more like Buddhas. And once we make the vow to make them part of our lives, they remain with us as a mirror. And we have no references for our behavior. We have no aspirations. We've never clarified our intention. We may not notice what we're doing. And once we start to get familiar with the precepts, you know, then like, do not steal. Is this stealing? Is this dwelling on past mistakes? I wonder. So sometimes we call these our moral guidelines, and like we never call them rules. And guidelines, it doesn't mean that these are arbitrary, but there's no deity watching. There's no central church watching. Ideally, each one of us does our own practice. We don't look around and judge others. Even as a teacher, I do not look around and judge others. Now, if someone else's action affects us directly, if they're, you know, indulging anger on us or whatever, then we might need to say something, right? Lie to me, I might need to call you on it or something, but that's not about me worrying about your precept keeping. Generally, to look around is a huge distraction and a waste of time. So, but doesn't mean these are arbitrary. It doesn't mean you can go ahead and kill and steal if you really want to. So guidelines might not be the best word. It's almost more like, I don't know, these are statements or observations which you can verify for yourself. Like, if you lie for selfish reasons, there will be negative results, even if they're not immediately obvious. Give it a try. Like, so these are observations, kind of like the Four Noble Truths in a way, that are just, they're not just something that we need to swallow and believe, but that yeah, test this out. You're probably going to find that these are true. So for instance, if we do lie for selfish reasons, there's a whole host of things. I mean, of course, maybe we get caught in the lie, but even if we don't, we might live in fear that we will get caught in the lie, have to tell other lies to cover up that lie, and get more complicated and stress us out. People end up not trusting you. Maybe we're acting out of a desire to protect our ego. So the list of karmic repercussions can go on and on. So in our lineage, we have, in Soto Zen and in Dharma Rain, which is where I trained, and it's a much bigger temple, they have a whole retreat around the ceremony of Jukai. So the Jukai, we call it the Jukai retreat, and it actually has a whole number of ceremonies within the retreat that lead up to the precept taking ceremony. We're a smaller sangha, and so we just do that Jukai ceremony, receiving the precepts and formally becoming a Buddhist. And I always thought that was very interesting and significant, that when you formally become a Zen Buddhist, you don't promise to meditate, you don't promise to study the Dharma, you don't promise to attend Sangha events, you promise to keep the precepts as best you can. To me, that really points to the significance of them. So this formal step of receiving the precepts and formally becoming a Buddhist is optional, but encouraged. If you feel any desire or interest in it, then, you know, correspond with me about it. You can send an email to info@brightwayzen.org and it'll get to me. But it's also a very individual choice. So there can be people in a sangha who practice deeply and participate regularly and just never do take this step. And so I just really recommend that you, unless you're really good friends with somebody, just like don't ask people about it. You know, I mean, you might express like, I'm thinking of doing that. But just kind of putting people on the spot, like, are you gonna take the precepts? Yeah, just don't do it. We'll find out, right? Anjuka, we'll find out who's taking the precepts. So, but we all study the precepts every year because of their value as a practice tool. So I talk a lot about that in my podcast episode 165, The Buddhist Moral Precepts as a Practice for Studying the Buddha Way. So just now it's just kind of a random list of things that I wanted to mention about the precepts before I open it up. But note that the precepts are all about relationship. Relationships are where our understanding is tested and where we try to enact our aspirations. And I once had a teacher say to me, and it's always stuck with me, people bring out the worst in us. And from the point of view of Zen practice, that's a good thing. That is like, the worst is in there. It's just sometimes we need to rub up against something before it comes to the light. So better that it comes to the light. So it's very, very challenging. You know, even people who've been practicing for a long, long time will just, you know, come to me and be like, but this one relationship just got, and that's where it is. Our karma sometimes just doesn't mix with somebody and we have a difficult time, or, you know, we have difficult work relationships or something like that. So that's where all these precepts come to bear. And precept work is a central part of most people's practice here, particularly those later, well, all of them, because even the first ones are kind of, they have a real literal level, but they also can get quite subtle. Sometimes people have a question about, you know, particularly if they're thinking about taking the precepts formally, is what about kind of the letter of the law? How closely exactly are we expected to keep these precepts if we promise to keep them, right? I mean, not only just are we gonna slip up, especially on those later ones about just like not dwelling on past mistakes or indulging anger or whatever, but in particular, people are curious about whether that means you have to be vegetarian. And in our lineage, is not the case. There are lots of forms of Chinese Buddhism in which vegetarianism and Buddhism are very, very closely wed. And we do ask there to be only vegetarian food in the Zendo itself, on the Zen Center premises. It's kind of a nod to that. But generally speaking, it's like people make their own choices. The idea being we just don't kill people. It's like the most basic one. And then we extend that not killing out just as far as we can. And remind ourselves that, like I said before, for whatever reason you're breaking a precept, there is still karma. So if you are living in part by killing things, then, you know, there's a cost to that. certainly to the other beings and to our own heart. And that's why it's good to just be aware and mindful and not just do it, you know, thoughtlessly. People ask sometimes about intoxicants, whether this means, you know, no intoxicants at all. And, you know, again, in our lineage, it's very, you know, in that sense, we said, do not abuse intoxicants. Now, monks aren't supposed to use them at all, the fully ordained monks, but like as lay people, we just, you know, and what does abuse mean? This really means being honest with ourselves. And we are the ones who decide for ourselves what each of these precepts looks like in our life. And then there's also, there are different ways of expressing sexuality. And so I had a Dharma sister, have a Dharma sister who's practiced polyamory for many, many years. And her teacher, one of my teachers, like just confessed, he just couldn't really get his mind around that one. But like that was, you know, it, when you look at the spirit of the precept, the spirit of the precept is about respect. And so I guess if this is something that you can do with respect and honesty, then for you, that's keeping the precept. And then one more thing, I think it's helpful to, and this will become more obvious as we study, there are different levels to all of the precepts. So there is the physical and literal level. You know, they're real, it's basically, you know, don't kill people, don't steal stuff, don't cheat out, you know, cheat on your partner, don't, you know, sleep with other people's partners, don't, you know, lie and whatever, all that kind of sexual misconduct. Yeah, do not lie, do not, originally, interestingly, was do not deal in intoxicants. There's a whole different level to it. A polishing clarity. So there's that real, and let's see, do not speak, decide not, do not dwell on past mistakes. The real literal level of that was do not gossip about people. We also think about do not dwell on our own mistakes, but the original kind of concrete level of that was do not badmouth others, do not praise self or blame others, so not building yourself up, do not be stingy with dharma or wealth, do not indulge anger, do not defame the three treasures. So there's, you know, do not indulge anger. An obvious example of that, right, is losing your temper and saying something or, you know, doing something. But all of these, in a sense, we can kind of break them in our mind too, right? So then there's this kind of karmic or mind aspect to it, where you can kind of kill something by just wanting it to be gone, not wanting it to be part of your universe. You can steal something by kind of conniving to get it, even though it really didn't come to you fairly or naturally. So there's a subtlety to all of that. And then there's even kind of beyond the karmic and the mind, there's just a very spiritual aspect to all of this. And it's helpful in our Kyoju Kaimon, those verses that happen after each of the grave precepts. This is on page 30. So the first of those are from the Bodhidharma One Mind precepts, and the second verse is from Dogen. So the first one, in a way, it's talking about, it's presenting a view of this precept in which it's pretty much impossible to keep it. You know, do not kill. In the realm of the everlasting Dharma, holding no thought of killing is the precept of not killing. So like the slightest desire to reject or cut off, and now you've broken the precept. But then Dogen said, the life of Buddha increases with life. No life can be cut off. Continue the life of Buddha. Do not kill Buddha. In the sense that in the one, everything is part of one luminous reality and nothing can be cut out of it. And thus, so it can go on to this kind of spiritual level of the precepts. So I will leave it there. So anyone who has practiced with the precepts for a while, whether you have received them formally or not, welcome to say something, share some of your experience, talk about how it's been valuable for you.
I have two thoughts in my mind about this, and I have presented precepts in the past, and one of the first things I do, better for better or worse, is I try to figure out what was the kind of person that this was addressed to. And so that's why the history that you gave is very important to me, because if I understood correctly, even these 16 Bodhisattva precepts were in fact originally addressed to monks, were they not?
Well, those first six are in common with, you know, lay and monk and whatever. The rest of them are really not, because you gotta have those six, you know, do not kill, do not steal, do not, but the rest of them are really not, they were part of the Bodhisattva precepts that arose in China. And pretty much as soon as those Bodhisattva precepts arose, there were a lot more lay people involved in receiving the precepts as well. And the monks, because the one thing was the monks in China, those 250 plus rules that the Buddha made for his monks became less important, because the monks weren't wandering around the countryside begging. They had to live in monasteries because it was colder and because they didn't have the same ability to go beg. I mean, besides, you can't have like 150 monks show up this small town, like, feed us, you know. So they had to be more responsible for their own food. And so what they had was more of a, they called them shingi. They had the regulations for the monastery. So when you were training in the monastery, there were a million and one rules about what you did, when you did it, and all that stuff. So then the emphasis became less on those Vinaya precepts and more on the Bodhisattva precepts.
I mean, it's good for me to know. I like to keep that in mind, and I will, but, and that tees up my next question, but I will say, to that point of the history, the first six are almost word for word the yamas and niyamas of the Vedas, which is from the Hindu tradition. So they go back even another couple of thousand years than the Buddha. So I think about the precept and who it was addressed to, and then I put it into historical context, which is far different from where we are now. Where I get to, and I thought about the one on sexuality a lot. I was getting ready to sign up for it, and then somebody else signed up for it. Maybe I'll do it next year. But I feel as though I get into this thing where it's not clear what right and wrong is. It is highly
wrapped up in, I can't think of the right word, the time, the incident, the context around the individual or the individuals involved. And I sometimes feel like we could just get on this slippery slope, to use that expression, of, well, you know, their marriage was really awful and he was beaten up on her a lot and she's really a good person. I mean, you can really do a lot of weaseling on the precepts. So my question or comment or whatever you want to, however you want to deal with it, is how do you keep that from getting out of control? That contextual part of it. That's my question.
Yeah, that's why we study the precepts every year. You know, it really is, I think they're really brilliantly constructed because they are, they don't give you that many answers, right? They give you kind of a spirit of the law, but then, I don't know, is this right? Is this wrong? Like, you know, inevitably, it seems like when we talk about do not kill, people are like, should I pick up the ants that are in my house and carry them outside? And then people point out, but then they've lost their way and they're going to die anyway. And like, you know, and then and that's kind of funny, but it is like any situation starts to get pretty complicated in some ways when you really want to keep these precepts, but you know, they give us some reference point, some spirit, and sometimes they can simplify things, right? Like how many of us have, you know, go ahead, take my Netflix login and, you know, go ahead and log on to my free cable, or go ahead and take this thing, and, you know, and sometimes I take it anyway because, like, my husband wants it, and I don't know, like, I'm not going to hold him to the same standards, but if it was just me, I would just say, no, I don't do that because I don't want to steal. I don't know. Sometimes it can be simpler, but, Ran.
I'm pretty sure I told you this before, when you asked me why I left the first sangha that I belonged to, and I said, and I'm bringing it up because to me, there's a conflict between no intoxicants and not disparaging the sangha. You know, I was after two or three years, a small group of the people closest to the sensei leading the Zendo, you know, came to me and during one of the break times and, you know, asked me if I wanted to join them taking LSD during a meditation session. And I was like, you know, I just really wasn't into that. It felt like that was just totally, you know, and this wasn't like, oh, I weighed this against the precept on that or anything. It's just like, that's just not where I'm going to go, you know, with meditating. But it became, I did not want to have a dokusan with the primary sensei in Atlanta and have to be confronted with, well, I say something that's going to just to thoroughly disrupt the sangha. And my choice was to just leave the sangha at the time, you know. You know, sometimes, you know, you get between more than just one, and you make a choice that you're not going to do intoxicants, you're not going to disparage the sangha, you're not going to disrupt other people, you're not going to gossip, or even if that's not gossiping or whatever, it's just trying to find a place that's the least trouble to everybody. And how else will you deal with it, you know?
Yeah. Thank you for sharing, making that point. Mick?
Yeah, I wanted to just kind of, I guess, I don't know. These are so fascinating to me because I think that like it, you can't make it more clear, right? If our lives were built in such a way that there were like rules that were like very clear cut and you could follow, like existence wouldn't have the kind of dynamic and vibrant like dimension that it has. And so I mean like of course these rules are like difficult and opaque and it's not really clear. And I think that's one of the reasons that I like them so much is that you have to take them. They're about a personal experience through your own life and what they mean to you is different because your existence is going to define what these things are like they grow with you in a way like that. And I think that like the I don't know, I feel like that didn't make any sense. But I also like at the same level it's like don't, you know, like there are points in my life where I'm like sitting around and I'm like, you know what? No. This is very clear. Like, don't lie here. This is very clear. Like, don't get angry here. This is very clear. Don't, you know. And so I don't know. I think like with most things then, like in some ways they're very clear and in some ways they're impossibly unclear. But revisiting them is like a process. You have to do it constantly. You have to constantly like revisit them and see what they mean and see how they direct you to go because they're different for me every day. And I love and hate that about them.
Thank you. Yeah, you reminded me to point out that our version of the precepts have that prescriptive and proscriptive, I guess, like the negative and the positive phrasing, which is something that was really an innovation of, I think, Les K. of Canando, maybe it comes from other places as well, but it really calls attention to how impossible or infinite these are, because, you know, even if you stop doing the bad thing, like how do you do the positive thing? You know, how do you cultivate and encourage all life? How do you honor the gift not yet given? What is communicating truthfully, really truthfully, you know, not authentically, not hiding, letting ourselves being seen, maintaining modesty, extolling virtue, sharing understanding, giving freely of self. And it's just, you know, there's a lifetime of work there. And one thing people might want to do, for one thing, I wanted to mention a practice that Kyogen recommended when we were doing precept study, which was to read the Kyoju Kaiman every evening, just to read it and then spend a few moments just reflecting, and or a recollection practice he talked about, which is just kind of sitting and drawing the day through your mind from beginning to end and noticing where there were places of constriction and difficulty or conflict, or where you broke a precept or you might have wanted to break a precept. So that can be a helpful exercise during precept study. And one thing that I did as well was I translated the precepts for myself. I took each one of them and I just put them into different words that really resonated with me. And I felt like, I feel like over the process of after having originally received the precepts at Jukai in 1996, when I was 24, and then, you know, living with them through the years, it's like a few of them made sense to me right away, but others of them, it's almost like I got really converted to the precepts gradually and kind of one by one through my own personal experience of like, ouch, yeah, I don't really want to break that one anymore. Like really, you know, it moving from that realm of like somebody told me this wasn't a good thing to do, or I kind of know I shouldn't do it, to like, I really don't want to do this. Like I have examined this closely enough for myself that I know this is a bad idea. So one more last comment, anybody? Go.
So this will be my fourth time studying the precepts here. And I think this is the first year where I'm really internalizing the precepts. And I do feel like the first year I did the recollection thing and I was looking for these opportunities. Well, there's an opportunity. I see this precept in this situation and I'm just looking for them. And it's just getting increasingly, I mean, I really appreciate what Mick says, frustrating, kind of annoying to a point where, you know, like for example, the vegetarian thing, very comfortable with eating animals. I, you know, vegetables were alive too. They just don't scream as loud when you kill them, right? So, but I just, knowing about the animal industry, the way that things are in the world right now, I can't do it. I took a vow and I'm very personally, you know, I see it in this vow of this, it's more than just eating the animal at this point in my eyes. And that's just the first precept. I imagine that this will continue to happen every year that we revisit these and continue to look inwards and internalize the precepts. And I'm really excited. I'm always very excited to hear the precepts from other folks and gain their perspective. I think that's really valuable.
Looking forward to it. Let's see, you're still muted. Are you still there, Linda?
Oh, okay, hi. Yes, I had an unstable connection for a second, so I didn't hear. Anyways, okay, so I have a question. Let's say some of the teachings of Buddhism, maybe I'm not comfortable with, such as reincarnation, okay? Is it okay to take the precepts if some of the teachings I'm not comfortable with?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on which teachings, right? If you're comfortable with the precepts, then I'm good.
Okay.
Like, if you were saying, I don't know about that precept. I want to keep on indulging anger. But, like, no, basically, yeah, so if you agree to the precepts, then it really, you know, the other, you can feel ambivalent about plenty of the other stuff. And, you know, just for one thing, like, I don't believe in reincarnation either. So, like, you know, that's definitely not a problem.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Sure. If you are considering at all the possibility of receiving the precepts and, you know, I mean, you can wait, you can think about it. I think that's lovely and fine. But if you are like, I think it is fine to receive them before you're 100% on them, or 100% on Buddhism, or whatever. Like, if you're not quite sure of your ability to live up to them, or you're not quite sure what they're going to do to your life, or, you know, I mean, yeah, if you have misgivings, by all means, honor them. But it's natural to really not know what you're getting yourself into. And that's kind of just part of the process. It's, if you can trust, you know, this path enough, if you can trust this Sangha enough, if you can trust me enough, then you're like, all right, you know, this is probably going to be a good thing. Then go for it. All right. Offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.